Ladies and gentlemen, to review, there will be class next week, but then after that, during Christmas, New Year's, there will be no class. And the class that follows after next week will be the one after New Year's. So New Year's comes out on a Sunday, I believe.
It's the first of the year.
This year. They got it right. Yes, sir.
Since we're not having a class, tell the class on Eric Christmas, you could use volunteers to glean and pack and deliver food to the homeless in the neighborhood at Eli's or the vinegar factory. So if you'd like to help out, because Lucas is one of our stalwarts, he helps us out every year at the vinegar factory. He's retired.
When do you do it?
Between 9 and 10 at...
Saturday night?
Yes, Saturday night.
Saturday night, yeah.
Good. So please let us know. We could use some help.
There we go.
It's an incredibly... Please, would you let Brendan just tell us quickly about it in a second? It's something very, very tough.
Terry, you mean?
Yeah.
Terry.
Go on.
It's good.
A touching thing.
It is. I wasn't the only one there that night, and it is. I've done it a few times.
But it's specifically the Israeli kids.
Yeah, it is. Well, right, we had a family with the Israeli kids. They sat in the back of our truck with gentlemen who are come to us.
Lucas.
Who drives the truck. And Sharon has great stories to tell on the way.
He volunteers his own truck.
Yeah.
Cool.
And really, it's you come and everybody's very pleased.
It happened
well. It's a wonderful thing.
Good. That's good.
We called up the Yorkville Common Pantry. It shows where the conditions are. Also, Metropolitan Council for
Jewish Poverty,
the same situation. I had some donors call me up for clothing. I called them up, can you pick it up? Our funds are not enough. We can't pick up food and clothing. Mm-hmm. At Yorkville Common Pantry, they said, we don't have any more funds left. We can't have anybody at night. I said, well, we'll pay for somebody at night. So they couldn't do it. So Brenda went over there with Lucas and a bunch of people. What?
Terry.
And they dropped off food. They were homeless men and women sleeping in the street.
Good.
And they dropped
terrific. Very good. It's a worthwhile thing to do. I join Richard with that. Number two, I wanted to mention to you our member, Alan Mayer, informed me of the fact that there was a very worthwhile exhibit in this neighborhood. And I went there today. Naomi and I went this afternoon. I wanted you all to know about this. At the Center for the Study of the Ancient World, which is a department at NYU, it is located on East 84th Street, 15 East 84th Street, right here. It is, some of you go back far enough with me and Arzarua to have an association with that building. That was the location of, I think it was our second Passover Seder. Second Passover Seder for Congregation Or Zarua. We were there two years in a row. That was the old building of the American Jewish Congress. May it rest in peace. The Congress, when it was alive and well, was located there. And that building was sold subsequently, eventually to NYU. We actually considered buying it at one point, but as is the case with that and buildings like that, it was too much money. So somebody else bought it, and NYU bought it, and it's now this Center for the Study of the Ancient World. And there is currently an exhibit on the archaeological work that has been done in Dura Europis. Dura Europis is a major archaeological site in Syria. And I may actually have addressed something else within Dura Europus this next Shabbat. We'll see. But it was a, it is a major site. It is still being studied. There is yet much archaeological work that's to be done. But the work that I had been exposed to was actually at the Society of Biblical Literature, had to do with the interpretation of the paintings on the walls of the synagogue in Dura Europus. There is a synagogue that dates from the latter part of the 2nd century, and the paintings date from the beginning of the 3rd century. And very, very interesting, because they are paintings of biblical scenes, but they don't always go according to the Bible. So that's one of the reasons why scholars are interested in this. So it's right here. It's just down the block. It's on East 84th Street. There's no fee to go in. It's free admission. So I highly recommend it, and it's really worth a while. I think if you go, you'll be well rewarded. Alan, do you agree with me?
Yes.
This is material that the work was done by Yale, by a group of archaeologists from Yale, and French archaeologists, and British archaeologists, and there are some very significant remnants that you see that are otherwise in Yale, because that particular point is very interesting. A lot of archaeology went on in the early 30s in the Middle East. Tremendous amount. It's true in Syria, it's true in Iraq, and it's true in Jordan and in Israel. And we were talking about it afterwards, and of course the reason why it all went on is that that was the period of, that was a colonial period. It was the post-World War I period, where each of the major powers was given a mandate. It was a British mandate in Palestine, the French were in Syria and Iraq, and as a result of that, all of the scientific work was done at that particular point in time. When the Arabs began to rebel against that, that was the end of it, and essentially it was the end of it to this day. Nothing has happened of any real value since that time in this area. Because of Arab nationalism, the whole thing went to pot. But what was done is extraordinarily significant, very, very significant. And apparently, they say here, and I wasn't aware of this, and I'm so surprised that I'm even doubtful, but I'm sure that what we read is true, but you had sent to me, Alan, that the paintings, the wall paintings, are located in Damascus. The Syrians removed them, and they are all in the museum in Damascus. Correct. They have been since the 30s. Well, they were probably after the 30s when they were taken out, but they are in the museum in Damascus, which, gosh, you know, stuff like that is so amazing. It's really top of the world class stuff. It's just unbelievable stuff. And to think that there's such chaos there now, and you don't have tourism. This thing that people should be looking at, going to the museums in Damascus. It's just, you know, it was bad enough before. It's terrible what's going on. You realize the scholarly ramifications of some of this. It just multiplies the tragedy of what goes on in these countries. It's just terrible.
How do you get the address, Rabbi?
How do you get the address? 15 East 84th Street. Couldn't be easier. 15 East 84th Street. Right across?
San Ignatius.
No, not San Ignatius. It's East 84th Street. East 84th is between 5th and Madison. It's between 5th and Madison.
Across from the school.
No, there's nothing there. It's just apartments. Just apartments. 84th Street.
I saw it on my way
here. The other exhibition that everyone might want to see is every Monday. They're turning the page of a complete Bible from Lisbon from 1480 at the Metropolitan Museum. It's only here for 8 weeks. And it's one of the few, of course, intact Bibles that survive the Inquisition. And it's beautifully illustrated. And the Met is very proud to show it because it also, of course, is the parallel to all the illuminated manuscripts from the Christians and the Muslims, because the same artists were sought after to illustrate, because that was a sign of your wealth and your power. But this one is not.
Where is it at the Met?
It's right in the first floor in the medieval, the Byzantine area.
Right.
As soon as you walk through the parallel corridors from the main hall to, if you're going to see a beautiful Christmas tree with the angel.
Yeah, let's see. In relation to the Christmas tree,
right,
where is it?
Right in front of the Christmas tree. It's the Met's
right,
opportunity
front.
To have balance. It's very proper, but it's an exceptional loan.
I like that. It's wonderful.
It doesn't travel much.
I had no idea. Where did you find out about this?
I'm at the Met 3 days a weekend.
Well, that would help. That's good.
But I sent a note to Deborah to please put it in the weekly email for everyone.
Sure.
I thought it would have been of interest to our whole community.
Absolutely.
I sent it right away. I sent
absolutely.
It just 3 weeks
both,
ago.
These are extraordinary resources right
they
here
are.
In the neighborhood.
Right.
Man, it's
and
just amazing.
You would never, ever see it.
No? It's just wonderful. It's a wonderful thing. It's terrific. Thirdly, I wanted to report to you on the results of my research. You had asked a question last time about the commentary that was strange to me, as well as to us, Likutei Rashi. Jay had asked about that, and I did some exploration into that, and found that what our first impression was that maybe these were manuscripts, other manuscripts of Rashi, or earlier Rashi before the Rashi that we have. That's not what it is. The Likutei Rashi is a commentary that's recently been put into the Gemaras, which actually is Likutim. They are collections of Rashis elsewhere in the Talmud where the same subject is dealt with. So that apparently is what the value of this particular thing is. Rashi occasionally deals with things elsewhere, sometimes in a more expansive way. Interestingly enough, sometimes Rashi contradicts himself. And that's a scholarly issue, why Rashi does things like that. Either is he changing his mind? Is it the difference of context between where these two things appear in two different places? Did Rashi maybe forget what he said the last time? he didn't have a computer. He was writing these things in the wintertime when he had the long winters in Troyes, in Champagne. So we'll never know the answer to the question, but that's what the Likutei Rashi is. And they're valuable to look and see these other places that Rashi comments on similar material, or the same material, but it's elsewhere in the Talmud. Okay? Okay. We are on page 2b. 2b1. And we finished the Mishnah last time, and we're going to begin the Gemara tonight. Okay? Now, I think it's worthwhile just page back a few pages till you get, at least in the Hebrew page, you get a picture of the first daf bet amud aleph. So just page back about three pages. And that's the one that, with a big square top, with the word Dine right here at the top of the Hebrew text, Dine. I just want to review with you the beginning of the Mishnah, which is here in the Hebrew text, simply so that we'll have it in mind, because the Gemara will not comment on the end of the Mishnah, but will comment on the beginning of the Mishnah. It took us really a few weeks to go through the Mishnah, so let's just see the very beginning of the Mishnah so that we have it in mind. Dine mamonot bishlosha, gzelot vechabalot bishlosha. Then it goes on, nezek chasin nezek tashlumei kefel tashlumei arba'a v'chamisha bishlosha. Dine mamonot bishlosha. The laws, monetary laws, are to be adjudicated by a panel of three judges. Gzelot vechabalot, thefts, and chabalot, torts, damages, are also to be adjudicated by a court of three. Okay? That is the piece that the Gemara is now going to address. Those two statements, Dine mamonot bishlosha, gzelot v'chabalot bishlosha. Okay, now let's go then to 2B1. Okay, the Gemara says, Atug zelod v'chavalot lav dine mamanot ninhu. The Gemara raises a question with the beginning of the Mishnah. If you can follow the Hebrew, I'll translate from Aramaic into Hebrew. V'chi, atu is v'chi in Hebrew, v'chi. V'chi gzelod v'chavalot einam dine mamanot. Do you mean to imply, or do you mean to say, that thefts and damages are not themselves subcategories of monetary law? I realize that the Mishnah is a pretty concise statement of the law. The Mishnah says two things. First, it says, Dine mamano b'shlosha, that monetary law deals with a court of three. Then it says, Gezelot v'chavalot b'shlosha, Gezelot, thefts, and damages with a court of three. Well, that implies that thefts and damages are not dine mamanot. They're not monetary law. The question of thefts is basically monetary law. All right? When you steal something, you steal something that has a value. Then when we have to figure out what happens, we have to assess the value, among other things. And, you know, we go from there. But in fact, as far as monetary law goes, the law of dine mamonot, gzelot, are certainly a subcategory of it. Okay? So the way the Mishnah is formulated, it's as if these are two different things. So the Gemara says, V'chi, do you mean to say, Zelot, V'chabalot, Lav, Dinei Mamonot, Minu? That they're not monetary law? Amar Rabbi Abahu, says Rabbi Abahu, Mahein Katani. Well, what the Mishnah is telling us, it's as if there's a colon after the introductory statement, Dine mamonot bishlosha, colon. The laws of the monetary laws are in accord with three, colon. And it explains what monetary laws are. What are we referring to that's in accord with three? Okay? Right? That's not such a high thing to understand. Alright, so that's what it says. Amar Rabbi Abahu Mahen Katani. And then he goes on to explain. Mahen Dine Mamonot. What do we mean by Dine Mamonot? Monetary law? Gezelot v'chavalot. We mean Gezelot, theft, and damages. Aval Hoda'ot v'chavalot lo. Oh, but other types of monetary transactions are, by virtue of further defining the term of dine mamonot as being gezelot v'chabalot, thefts and damages, in fact, dine mamonot could extend to some very other important areas of the law. And what the Mishnah is doing, says Rabbi Abahu, is excluding certain things by immediately telling us, when I'm telling you dine mamonot, monetary law, I am limiting this to the following. Gezelot v'chabalot. Okay? So we are excluding something else. What are we excluding? We are excluding the laws of, let's see, it says, aval hoda'ot v'halva'ot, lo. This does not apply, or something, there is a difference in the courts and the way the court functions regarding hoda'ot and halva'ot. Now, let's see what hoda'ot and halva'ot are. Okay, hoda'ot and halva'ot. See if I can get a source on this. Okay. Exodus 18:21. Some of our basic monetary law Lips, yes. No, that's not it. Sorry. Oh, Exodus 22:7-8. There it is. Exodus 22:7-8. What sense? Our basic monetary laws come from Parashat Mishpatim. That is after the Ten Commandments. The following parsha is the sort of the heart of the civil law. And the essential to the civil law is monetary law. Okay, dinei mamonot. So here in the discussion of monetary law, chapter 22, I'll start with verse 6. Ki yiten ish el re'ehu kesef o kelim nishmor. When a man gives to his neighbor either money or objects to guard. And this is a special kind of relationship here. This is a custodial relationship. Right? Or we could call it a bailee and a bailor. Okay? You give me something to guard. Excuse me, what are my responsibilities toward you? Okay? Do I have any responsibilities? Let's say I lose it. Let's say I damage it. Let's say somebody steals it from me. Do you have any rights to have an action against me? Okay? That's the question here, which we have in the 22nd chapter of Exodus. Okay? So when a man gives money or goods to another for safekeeping, and they are stolen from the man's house, right? Normally, if you give me something to watch, and you don't pay me to watch it, then in fact, I have no responsibility, with the following exception. The assumption of the law is that I can't be negligent. Okay? If you pay me to do something, then I have additional responsibilities. But if you haven't paid me, then my responsibilities are very few, with the exception of negligence. If I take upon myself and I say to you, I'll watch it, then I have to exercise reasonable prudence in guarding your object. Not the level of prudence or the level of guarding that would be necessary if you paid me something. If you paid me, then I have to exercise more prudence in my guarding of your object. Okay? So that's the subject we're talking about here. A man has stolen the object that you put in my charge. I'm the custodian, and somebody has stolen it. If the thief is caught, he shall pay double. Okay? Generally, that's the case in terms of theft in the Torah, the thief pays double. If the thief is not caught, the owner of the house shall depose before God that he has not laid hands on the other's property. Okay? Now, that is to say, if I am the custodian, I'm a non-paid custodian, and you come and you say, well, where's my property? I say, somebody stole it. How does that guy know I'm telling the truth? It could be that I'm lying. He says, no, that's not true. You took it. I put it in your charge. You liked it. And you took it. You took it. How do we know who's right? Okay? We have a problem here. We have a problem. Okay? So, Im lo yimatzeh ganav v'nigra bal habayit ela Elohim. Now this is crucial. The Hebrew is really more important than the English because the English is somewhat obfuscating. If the theft, the thief will not be found, v'nigra bal habayit, right? The person who is the owner of the house shall be brought el ha'Elohim. Now here it says, shall depose before God. But that's not what the Hebrew says. Well, we don't know what the Hebrew means. I'm reading it to you as Elohim, because maybe it means judges. What does Elohim usually mean?
God.
God. Usually means God. Okay? How do you know it means judges? You read ahead. And in fact, that's what the Gemara is going to say. Right? The Gemara is going to say that. But at least as far as the biblical text says, it's somewhat hard to understand. You should bring the person before God, or maybe it means judges. Im lo shalach yado bimelechet yado bimelechet re'ehu, that he did not send his hand into the work of his neighbor, namely that the Balabayev didn't take it. Okay, so that has to be brought. He has to do something, some sort of an oath or something like that. He has to take. Im lo yimatzei ganav nigra Balabayev Elohim im lo shalach yado. And that's as if im lo shalach yado probably means that. Im means that. So he has to make a statement that, or take an oath that, or something like that, that he has not stolen the property. I'll call davar pesha, is the next verse. For every matter of transgression, or, what, how did you translate?
Crime.
Okay? For every matter of crime, assuming that this probably has something to do with what we just read, Al Shor, Al Chamor, Al Se, Al Salma, Al Kol Aveda. Whether we're talking about an ox or a donkey or a sheep or a Salma, a dress, or Al Kol Aveda, for any loss. Asher Yomar Ki Hu Zeh. Now translate that for me. Asher Yomar Ki Hu Zeh. I don't have the foggiest idea
what
he
did. It.
What?
That is the guy that brought before the judges will agree to say that he took part of.
Could be. It's one possible way of understanding it. It surely is very hard Hebrew to understand. It's not at all clear what the Hebrew is saying there.
He's there. I mean, that like whatever the was specified prior to
that, he has shared the problem.
Well, the whole thing. Asher Yomar Ki Hu Zeh. What is
whatever was prior to that, he agrees with that list of things that he did wrong or whatever.
It's possible it means that. I agree with you. It could mean that, but it also might not mean that. You're right. I mean, that's it's one of these obscure Hebrew phrases. We really don't know what it means, but it could mean that. It could be what Ram just said. That's the first way the Gemara is going to take it, by the way. Okay? Adha Elohim Yavo Devar Shehem. Until Hi Elohim, here we are again with Elohim. Until God, or up to God, or you have to bring the matter to God, or to the judges. Okay, to the judges. Shall go the words of both of them. Asher Yarshiun Elohim. The one who Elohim declares to be guilty. Yishalem Shnayim L'Reyehu. He has to pay double to his neighbor. Okay? Now, this is the verse. This is talking about a custodial relationship. It is talking about some thief having taken whatever has been put in the charge of the custodian. We do not really know for sure whether the thief is a third party or it is the custodian himself. Right? At least from the perspective of the owner of the object, the owner really doesn't care. He just wants to get either the object or double his money on it so he can buy another object, and for whatever reason he's going to get an additional a payment will come as a result of it. But that matters to him. But of course the custodian doesn't want to pay if he's not subject to it. Okay? If he shouldn't be paying. So he will be interested in proving his case, maybe by virtue of an oath. Ki huze, right? This is what he is saying is really true. Right? That's the custodian who is saying that, and he's going to say it in front of the judges. Okay? Back to the text. This is where we got started. Okay? That is the case of hoda'ot. Hoda'ot. Hoda'ot, among other things, are a variety of cases where a person will be called upon to make an admission of some kind. An admission. Okay? Or a case of halva'ot. Halva'ot is a slightly different case. Halva'ah is alone. Halva'ah is alone. Again, I now borrow money from Richard. Okay? Comes time to pay the money back, and Richard says, pay my money back to me. And I say to him, what money? He says, well, the money I gave you. I said, I don't know what you're talking about. You gave me money? You know, you must have brought back from Ireland a little bit of that Irish whiskey, and you thought that you gave me money. It was one of these fantasies you have. And now you want me to suffer for it? I should suffer for your fantasy? Okay. All right. Well, how do we find out the answer to this? How do we find out the answer to this? Here, too, we will have to bring it to court in some way. We'll need a court to deal with this. This is a case sort of monetary law. It's kind of a case of monetary law, although it's an odd case of monetary law in all truth. But I'll tell you what. If you steal an object, right, or if you're a custodian for an object, it's very clear that you have to give back the object. Let's say you give me your silver tea set to watch. Comes the time to give you back the silver tea set, and I give you back $1,000. Will you be happy? Well, if the tea set was worth $50, you'd be happy. But if it's, let's say, equivalent, then the reality is you want your tea set. You gave me a tea set to watch out. Perhaps it watch out for. Perhaps it has family reminiscences. There are certain things about it that are very important to you. And you didn't give it to me because you wanted to sell it to me. You gave it to me because you wanted me to watch it. You were going away, and therefore you trusted me to watch it. Okay? So, in fact, objects themselves, when you are a custodian for an object, you are obligated to give back the object and not the monetary equivalent of that object. Okay? When you take a loan, right? If you borrow from me $1,000, are you required to pay me back the same $1,000? No. Because money is fungible. Money is not like a tea set. Okay? So you are required to pay me back money, but in fact it's not a case, if I deny or you deny that this transaction ever took place, it's actually different from a theft. Because we're no longer dealing with the original object. In fact, we have a monetary obligation that you've entered into, which is to pay back money. The equivalent amount of money, but not the same object. So it's not exactly the same as a theft. You see the difference between the two. Okay? All right. Yes, ma'am.
What if someone saw you using the object that you were
custodian? That's correct. Let's say somebody saw you. So now there may in fact be witnesses who are involved. And the witnesses can be the key players here. And so we could refer, number one, to the individual, or it could be witnesses. And it's true also in the loan case. In the loan case, somebody could come along and say, no, there are two possibilities here. One, I saw, there was no written contract here, but I saw this happen. One possibility. Another possibility is witnesses come along and they say, I heard Wexler say that Richard gave him a loan. Well, that's admissible in court because they were witnesses to me having said that. So witnesses can be crucial in all of this. And the witnesses will fall into the same category here of hoda'ot and halva'ot.
But in the case where someone's using an object, whether it be the silver teapot,
right.
Someone could have given a custodial. Does that create a diminution of the value that the custodial is responsible to pay back?
Because you've used the object. Because you're not supposed to use an object unless... Exactly, exactly. Correct.
Are we going to be addressing that?
We won't be addressing that because that's not particularly relevant to that. That is a relevant issue in the law of custodianship. It definitely is relevant. Yes?
So I have a property and I'm traveling to Babylon from Jerusalem.
Don't tell me properties because these are objects. Property law is totally different. Okay, you're okay.
I have a property and I'm traveling to Babylon.
Okay.
And in the property I have some objects that are valued.
Okay.
And I ask Dan to move to my place to live, not paying me rent, but to overlook my property and the object.
Well,
now, there are two issues.
This is a different issue. It's a completely different issue. Why? Because he's derived a benefit from it. Namely, he's lived in your house.
Yeah, if but I'm not allowed to have a vakiskan.
You're not allowed to what?
Last year, or the year before we study, that if I rent you a house, I cannot take a part of the house and live there too. A vakiskan, you call it.
Okay.
So here is something that I'm asking you to do.
Now, vakiskan is an issue of rabbinic law. It's an exception to a case. An exception to a case. Generally speaking, here in the case that you're describing to me does not involve a vakiska, because this is a case where, in fact, he's deriving a benefit from
it. No, I'm deriving the benefit.
Whoever is the keeper, he's the keeper. You've gone away. He becomes the keeper. But he is deriving a benefit from the fact that he's keeping, in that he is living in your house.
And I have a benefit that I have somebody...
Correct. But that's the same as if you were paying him $20. As soon as you enter into a transaction where you pay him something, then his obligations change toward you.
What if he doesn't want to live there? He only to do the favor for Richard. I mean, he does not want to be there. He won't grab.
Well, I wouldn't go into that because we're not studying the laws of custodianship. It's only relevant in that for whatever reason now the Gemara thinks, or the Gemara is raising the possibility, that the laws of custodianship and of loans, in fact, have to be dealt with differently from the perspective of the court. How do we know that? Well, because the Mishnah itself has set things up so that it defines its term of dinei mamonot in a very narrow form, namely, gezelot v'chabalot. Well, if it defines its term narrowly as gezelot v'chabalot, thefts and damages, that is to exclude something else. What is that something else? That something else is halva'ot and hoda'ot. Okay? The conditions of the custodian or the loan where we have these witness issues or the person himself, and somehow that's going to be dealt with differently. Now, of course, we'll wonder why it's going to be dealt with differently, but the way the Gemara has already concluded is that they are different. They are qualitatively different from normal thefts and from damages. Yes?
The custodianship has in it the element of stealing, or a resolution of the issue of custodianship can involve stealing, which then looks like bodily injury or theft rather than bodily injury. So there seems to be some kind of close connection.
Correct. There is a close connection, but there's a difference as well. It's not exactly clear why there is a difference. That's what the Gemara is going to be interested in. But the Gemara so far is setting us up to assume that there must be some difference, even though it's obvious that there's a lot of similarity between the two. Okay?
What is torts and what is contracts, in a sense? I mean, theft is a tort. Stealing something is a tort. Bodily injury is a tort. It's a civil wrong.
That's interesting insights. It's not the insight that Gemara makes, but it may be relevant. It may be relevant. And if in our legal system we conclude, as you just said, that we see the difference, that there is in fact a difference between these two, it will be articulated somewhat differently here, but still maintaining the difference between the two. It's interesting.
No reason to think that our view doesn't derive from the
It's possible. The rationales would be similar because they're responding to reality. There's certain issues in reality, and you'll see what those issues are as we progress here. Okay? So, itana. No, let's see, where do we stop here? Whatever it is that we are learning in the Mishnah that requires the court of three for thefts and damages does not apply, or does not apply exactly in the same way. We don't know really what we mean when we say it doesn't apply. In some way it doesn't apply to the subject of admissions and loans. Admissions in the custodial case, and loans, variety of things related to the loans. Utsricha. It is necessary that both clauses be stated. Okay? Namely, Dinei Mamonot Bishlosha, that's one clause. The law of monetary laws are dealt with in a court of three. And then the second clause is Gzelot V'Chabalot Bishlosha, the specifics. De'itana Dinei Mamonot, if it had only taught the first one, monetary law, I would have concluded that this applies as well, exactly for what Milt said. They're so similar that it would apply as well to admissions or to loans. Because they're also dinei mamonot. Okay? So that's what I would have thought had there only been one of the two phrases. And therefore the Mishnah comes and gives us the second phrase in addition to the first phrase. And if the Mishnah had only taught us the second phrase, namely, what requires a court of three? Thefts and damages, okay? And it didn't teach us the law, the first phrase, namely, the law, monetary law is in a court of three. I would have concluded from that the same subject and all the details apply also to the laws of admissions and loans. And the fact that the Mishnah teaches just gezelot v'chabalot, those two things, why does the Mishnah teach just those two and doesn't teach more than that? Mishum de ikar gimel dichtive begzot v'chabalot kativi, because the ikar, the basic idea that there is a requirement of a court of three, is written in scripture vis-a-vis these things, namely the gzelot and chabalot. That is where you find the mention of the court of three in the scriptures. All right. And then it explains that. So let's just go back and see what we sure we have then. Oh, if we had just taught Gzelot v'Chabalot, no, I'm sorry, I got it wrong, right? If it had only, the Mishnah had only taught Gezelot v'Chabalot, the second one, right? And it hadn't taught the first phrase about monetary law in general, I would have said that the same laws apply also to admissions and loans. And the reason why the Mishnah taught it the way it did by pointing out these two was not to exclude anything, but because it's in relation to those two that we get the number three. Right? And we wouldn't have learned that there's a difference between hoda'ot and halva'ot, admissions and loans, that is different from the general practice in monetary law. Okay? Now the Gemara goes on and then fleshes this out. Dichtiv, as it is written, v'nikrav bal habayit el ha'elohim. And the bal habayit, the owner of the house, the master of the house, shall approach the judge. Now we just read this, this is vis-a-vis the custodian. And remember I said to you that the phrase HaElohim, in those two verses is repeated three times. The two verses it's repeated three times. Okay? Because it is repeated three times, in that case, in the case of the custodian, because it is repeated there, in fact, what we learn is that three is what is crucial. Three is what is crucial. Okay? According to the Gemara here. Now, it doesn't really flesh it out in great detail. It will do that on page 3b. We're going to come back to this on 3b. But since we've mentioned it, I just think that it should be noted, all of this, the notion of a court of three, comes from the threefold repetition of the phrase HaElohim here in the discussion of custodians in the 22nd chapter of the book of Exodus. Okay? And Elohim then, as Henry originally said, is understood to be judges. I do want to sit on that for a minute, because of course it's not obvious why it means judges. It may mean judges, may be obvious because that's the only thing in the context it can mean. Although, in theory, it could mean other things. It could mean if it says, well, let's just see the language here, where a man gives mitzvah and they are stolen from the man, so the thief, he shall pay double. If the thief is not caught, the owner of the house shall depose before God. That's the way the English translation handles, should come before God, shall depose before God. That is to say, take an oath. So it's not an unreasonable possibility, but we really don't know what the Hebrew means. It is, in its own way, an interpretation. It's an interpretation. In all charges of misappropriation pertaining to an ox, an ass, a sheep, a garment, or any other loss whereof one party alleges this is it, the case of both parties shall come before God. He whom God declares guilty shall pay double to the other. Now, if I were an American fundamentalist reading this, probably it would never occur to me that this is a court matter. Rather, I would probably learn, you know, that you've got to go to your minister, or somehow maybe you have to have a right to, you know, stick your hand in boiling water or something like that in order to be able to figure out who is the party that is the just party here. Not at all clear that this is really recommending to us a court case. Now, I want to therefore read to you a very short excerpt from the Yerushalmi. Sometimes I find that it's very helpful to clarify these things to see by seeing what you have in the Jerusalem Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud, it's a somewhat similar beginning after the first Mishnah. Remember, the Talmud that we are studying is the Babylonian Talmud. In my research on this, what I did first was I went to see the Tosefta and the Tosefta Kifshuta. Interestingly enough, the Tosefta is a zero here. It doesn't help at all. My professor, Professor Rabbi Saul Lieberman, wrote a commentary to the Tosefta. Remember, the Mishnah was edited in the year 200. Left out of that are things we find in the Talmud are baraitot, left out of the Mishnah. That's what a baraita is. We find always the baraitot here in the Gemara. At roughly the same time, Rabbi Chia edited a collection of things that sometimes appear in the Gemara as baraitot, but it was edited as a separate volume called the Tosefta. Tosefta is like a Musa. It's the addition. Addition. Not edition, but addition. Okay? So Tosefta is very valuable in analyzing something more or less contemporaneous with the Mishnah. The great edition of the Tosefta was done by Saul Lieberman. And he wrote a commentary to the Tosefta called the Tosefta Kifshuta. Literally, the simple meaning of the Tosefta. It's a massive, brilliant commentary on the Tosefta. And what he does is that he interprets the Tosefta usually according to the Yerushalmi, according to the Jerusalem Talmud. If you look into the Jerusalem Talmud, See, when you read the Babylonian Talmud, you are frequently seeing the way in which an idea existed a few hundred years later. The Jerusalem Talmud predates the Babylonian Talmud by almost 200 years. Okay? So that you can sometimes get a closer insight, time-wise, into the meaning of something. That you find the Jerusalem. And since the Tosefta comes out of the same environment, out of the land of Israel, roughly around the year 200, and a little bit thereafter, the Tosefta itself, occasionally you see things in the Tosefta that the Babylonian Talmud was not that concerned about. They bring the Tosefta, but if you go back to the land of Israel, you can see, in a way, what the conversation was. Unfortunately, Lieberman died before he wrote his commentary to Sanhedrin. Lieberman's commentary to the Tosefta, which is this extraordinary work, is incomplete. It's incomplete. He was the dean of the faculty of the seminary. He maintained an apartment in Jerusalem. And I remember when I was a student, he would only teach the senior year students. And we always said, well, why didn't he teach more than that? And the vice chancellor of the seminary always said, you think we should take him away from the Tosefta Kishuta? What's the matter with you students? Don't you realize why we pay him? Not to teach you. We pay him so that he'll write the Tosefta Kishuta. And every time he would come out with another volume, we would all, what do we have to say? We were obviously an interference with his scholarship. So came the day, and unfortunately Lieberman died. He died in a very interesting way, perfect way for Lieberman. He died on an LL flight to Jerusalem, to Tel Aviv. But you know, it's the right way for some people to go. He had a heart attack in the air. He had a heart attack, and he died in the Shamayim. He actually died in the Shamayim, you know. That's where his neshama went up to the Kadosh Baruch Hu, right at 36,000 feet. So that's correct. I mean, we couldn't believe it when we heard Lieberman down. What happened? Take it easy. They said, because he died in the Shamayim. So what do you mean he died in the Shamayim? Mamashi died in the Shamayim. He was at El Al. He was going on a flight, 36,000 feet. He died in the air. But we are, as his students, some of us have always, we learned his methodology. The methodology is to go to the Yerushalmi. When you have something that seems odd, go to the Yerushalmi. You never know what you're going to find. And that's what he did in the Tosefta Kishuta. So although we don't have the benefit of his commentary on Sanhedrin, we at least try to learn from his ways that he would analyze a difficult text. So I went into the Yerushalmi, and Yerushalmi is fascinating. Yerushalmi, soon after it begins this discussion, brings a few different opinions, and one of which I wanted to share with you, and that was the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. A little story brought about Rabbi Akiva. And this is how it goes. This is Yerushalmi, Sanhedrin. The way the Yerushalmi is structured, it's structured by chapter and halacha. This is chapter 1, halacha 1, which means the first section. Rabbi Akiva, the Kedahava Barnash Azal by Midun Kumai. The Aramaic of the Yerushalmi is what we call Palestinian Aramaic. It is not the same as Babylonian Aramaic. It has a different tongue to it. And if you saw it, you might be even more sensitive to it than just listening to it from me. Could the Hava Barnash Azal by Midun Kumai? When a person, Rabbi Akiva says, Rabbi Akiva is about Rabbi Akiva now, Kada Hava Barnash, when a person would come, Azal Bai, and go and ask for a judgment before him, Hava Amar Le, he would say to the person, Havu yod'im lifnei mi atem omdim. Do you know who you are standing before? Lifnei misha amar v'haya ha'olam. Before he who spoke and created the world. Shenemar, v'amdu shnei ha'anashim asher lahem ariv lifnei Hashem. This is in Deuteronomy 19:17. The law says, and the two men who have a dispute shall bring their dispute before the Lord. And then he goes on, he says, V'lo lifnei Akiva ben Yosef. And not in front of Akiva, the son of Joseph. So in other words, what Rabbi Akiva is teaching here is that when it says lifnei Elohim, the purpose of the judge is to act as the mediator of the divine law. And therefore he would make it clear to those seeking judgment before him that they weren't getting a judgment from him, but he was rendering a judgment based on the divine law. Right? That then is the significance which you see in the Yerushalmi of Lifnei Elohim, before God. Okay? It is not just that the Elohim is a word for God, but the judge is the mediator of the divine word in the human community. Okay? That's the force which I got from the Yerushalmi on it, which I think is a fascinating, it's a beautiful idea. In the commentary here, a little later on, they'll say Elohim has a strength to it, and therefore it shows the importance of this kind of judge. There may be truth to that, but I think in the original the sense is here that it is the rabbi or the elder, the judge, who is the mediator of the divine law. Okay? Mark that name.
Elohim sounds like it's a plural word.
It is.
Why do we use it for one God?
That's a classic question. That is the Bible's use of it, of the term, which may have used, been used in other contexts for many gods, for one God. Okay? That's the basic piece of the Bible, and it's a, probably a borrowing from Canaanite. Okay? Yes?
Well, we talked about maybe the meaning being supposed to be the oak. Do we know whether or not the oak that he gives to a witness was administered before this time? Could this be north of power, having someone put their hand on a Bible?
Oh, yes. That's in the Bible itself. That is in the Torah. That is in the Torah, the idea of taking an oath for certain discrete subjects in certain discrete areas. And we'll get to some of those areas shortly. Not so much here. At least it's not explicit here. It may be implicit here. It may be implicit. It is, in fact, explicit vis-a-vis the law of loans. Right? And there it's, you'll see, we're going to come to that shortly. The law of loans, if I deny a loan, the Torah makes it very clear that there's an obligatory oath. There's an obligatory oath. The question is whether it is obligatory for all denials or only certain denials. And the reason why that is raised has to do with this biblical verse about the custodian, and you'll see it comes in shortly. Okay? Correct. That's correct.
Is it not problematic or sort of uncharacteristic to presume that in this one instance or other instances like this, that some guy is speaking for God?
I don't know the answer to that question.
I actually asked, is it problematic?
If it was problematic, probably it's problematic, yeah. because it assumes that we have God's spokespeople there.
And I mean, you said it was lovely, and it is, but isn't it also sort of...
Well, not where you have a court interpreting the divine law. Because even here, you really don't even have an individual. You have three people.
Okay. So when I ask them, is it characteristic then? Is that something that usually is the case, that sort of allowance is made for people to speak in the name of God.
It is that the Torah, the Torah itself, the Torah itself, if you remember the very the first class of the semester, I read to you where the Torah itself gives authority to go to the courts who sit in that day in order to adjudicate matters that need to be adjudicated. So the Torah gives that authority.
Okay.
The Torah itself gives that authority.
So it's not really.
No, it's not a problem. It's not a problem. Okay. I think it's interesting that you don't have a single individual who is interpreting, number one. And number two, it implies here that there is authority, that the individuals who can make those decisions have authority to make those decisions. And authority is an interesting question, because in fact there are two different issues involved in adjudicating something. One is that you know what you're doing, which is not the same thing as having authority. And it could be that...
Right.
Correct. It could be that having authority means you don't know what... You know, you could... If you have authority, you don't necessarily have to know what you're doing. Or we would hope that they would be the same. Now, the ideal situation is that they would be the same. When you have judges, that the judges would be competent judges. And that becomes an issue then that we'll always have to worry about. And you will see it's going to immediately arise here in the Gemara as well.
And
the level of competence of the judges.
Not just competence, but disinterested. I mean, equally important is disinterestedness.
Correct. Well, there has to be something special about the judges then. Okay? Yes, David.
As a practical matter, how were these judges appointed?
They were appointed by other judges. By the... This court, well, you'll see. I don't want to answer that fully because we're going to get to that in a little bit. There is the issue of mumchim, whether judges have to be mumchim. And mumchim doesn't necessarily mean in the Talmud what it means in modern Hebrew. In modern Hebrew, mumchim would mean experts, that they know what they're doing. But in the Talmud, the commentators of the Talmud don't take it that way at all. Rather, it means that there is a continuity of authority. The continuity of authority, and therefore the continuity of authority becomes crucial in being able to have these courts. Okay?
Even more fundamentally, was the system actually in effect?
Yes and no. The subject that we're dealing with now probably was in effect, but the Mishnah has covered a whole gamut of areas, and including criminal law and capital cases. And in fact, by the time of the Mishnah, all of our evidence is that it was not in effect. That in fact, Roman law was governing at that particular point in time. And therefore, some of the strictures of the Mishnah have to be understood in light of the fact that these were ideas and applications of the law which were somewhat theoretical because they really didn't govern at the time that we're reading them. Okay? Okay, let's keep going. Now the second, we've seen now the source of three judges as far as gezeilot go, as far as thefts go, but we haven't seen it as far as chavalot, the damages. So the Gemara really does this almost short shrift by just including, you'll see, damages in the area with the thefts. Chavalot, mali chaval begufo, mali chaval b'mamono. What difference does it make if we create a damage in a person's body? We have already learned the law if we create a damage in the thing a person owns. So that's the way the Gemara simply creates a logical connection between one area, namely the thefts, where we have some scriptural proof, and another area, which is chavalot. They're logically connected. I don't know that it's the most compelling logic I've ever seen, but the Gemara seems to, at least at this stage, accept it. Tana mahen mamonot. Tana mahen mamonot, gzelot v'chavalot. What... Now this is summarizing. the teacher of the Mishnah teaches what are dine mamonot, what are our monetary laws? Gzelot v'chabalot, these are laws of theft and laws of damages. Aval hoda'ot v'halva'ot, lo. But the area of admissions and loans, no. So in other words, whatever, there's some difference between that latter category of those two things vis-a-vis the first two things that are mentioned explicitly in the Mishnah. Okay? So, now that we've confronted that, the Gemara naturally will want to know how are these two things different. So that's the next subject that the Gemara deals with. The Gemara immediately says, how are loans and admissions different? How are they different? Well, one possibility is that in these area of admissions and loans, that we don't require a court of three. The Ha'amar Rabbi Abau, but don't you remember the teaching of Rabbi Abau who said, Shnayim Shedanu Dine Mamonot. Now get the language of Rabbi Abau. The language is very general. If two people render a judgment in dine mamonot, in monetary law, in general, it doesn't qualify it at all, as our Mishnah did qualify monetary law. All right? Remember, our Mishnah qualifies monetary law as applying only to gzeilot mechabalot and not to hodaot and habaot. And it's excluding certain things. But Rabbi Abau is excluding nothing. He's making a general statement about all monetary issues. Shnayim shedanu dine mamonot, if any case is judged by two, and that would imply including halvaot and hodaot, right? That which our Mishnah is excluding, lidivrei kol ein dinehem din. Everybody agrees that whatever those two judges decide is not worth a nickel. Right? Ein dinehem din. Their law is not law. Whatever their judgment is invalid. So it couldn't mean then, according to the Gemara, if we're trying to conclude that perhaps those two things of hoda'ot and halva'ot, admissions and loans, only require a court of two, couldn't be. The Gemara concludes something else. Since it couldn't be that, it has a different conclusion. But rather, it does not require ordained judges. Here, this is what I was referring to before, in answer to your question. Mumchim could mean two things. It's not really clear from the Gemara what it means. It could mean experts. So it could mean that there are two types of judges. It could mean that it means experts and non-experts. Now, there are some issues which you might argue were, you know, they're just sort of your average man, peers can make these judgments. But generally speaking, Jewish law doesn't work that way. It's a legal system of expertise, but expertise of a high order, And to just assume that any three people, can make a judgment in an area and they know enough in order to make that judgment is not at all likely. And therefore, the interpretation of lo ba'inan mumchim probably means something more forceful than that. And what it means in the context probably is lo ba'inan mumchim, in this area you don't mean ordained judges. That is to say, judges who judge based on the authority of the continuity of the legal system, that they have received their authority from other judges who have received their authority all the way back to Moses on Mount Sinai. Okay? You saw that we saw the original court of 70, well, the 71, that went back to Moses on Mount Sinai, well, after Mount Sinai. That God says to him to set up such a court. Right, Moses has original judicial authority. Then there is the divine sanction for this larger court. That larger court then appoints the smaller courts. Okay? Now anyone who is able to function has got to not only know the law, but to have the authority of an appointment. It's a case in our legal system, too. Mike, you said before that in British law, you said that before?
Judges appoint judges.
Judges appoint judges, okay.
The old boy network.
Okay, here we have an unusual system. I think it's an... I'm not sure really how it works, because in fact, even in our system here in New York State, if any of you remember the last election that we had, there was next to nobody to vote for in that last election. And if you voted for whatever judge there was, even there was nothing to vote for. Because the process of electing judges has a lot to do with the ABA's, or whoever does this in the legal community, they recommend judges. And then it becomes a question in the party system whether there is a tension in the party about whether to accept the recommendation of the judicial panel. But it's a basic problem that we have. But we in our system actually elect the judges. We do elect judges, but not all of them. Correct. Some of them.
We elect people that appoint the judges. In America, the judges
correct.
Basically are elected.
Well, even indirectly, you see.
Even
indirectly.
Some states, they're appointed.
In some states, yes. Very interesting.
Federal?
Well, but as you say, right, in federal, they're appointed, but by people who are elected. So it's a sort of indirect, it's an indirect system, but it has its source in the people, as it were. You do not have that in the Jewish system. You have what apparently is closer to the English system, as you say, where the judges are appointed, and that's the way the
first 70 were elected.
Well, by God, by God. No,
that's to get rid of 10 people from your tribe.
But if you remember, in the book of Numbers, these people have the divine, what does it say? Nevuah goes on them. They begin to prophesy. You know, they have a divine, suddenly the divine
channeling
comes into them. Correct. Correct. Okay? But here, let's go back to what we're dealing with, the mumcha now. Mumchim are people who are part of this legal tradition then. That sanction of the authorities in a continuous succession of authority. Oh no, they can't be, no, these have to be appointed. They have to be appointed then, and they have to be appointed based on their expertise, no doubt. Okay, the system of appointment had to do with the Nasi and with the Av Bet Din, the head of the court of 71, okay, would have certain appointment powers. Now keep in mind here too that the language, there's a historical context for this, for much of what we are reading, and realize that one of the great problems of the Roman period, finally, which manifests itself most significantly, finally in the second century, was the effort of the Romans to disrupt this system of continuity. We focus on the fact that the Romans forbid the study of Torah. That was not the only thing that was going on here. One of the things that the Romans were interested in doing, apparently, and they understood the way the system worked, was to break the system. The system itself is dependent upon continuity of appointment. And if you can break that system, even if you break it for a short while, you've broken it forever. Okay? Ultimately, the Romans were successful in doing this. The truth is, they succeeded. Eventually, the system of appointment and the continuity of the rabbinic system undergoes a crisis.
Yeah, they moved to Ramle.
They moved to Ramle first, but then in the time of Rabbi Akiva, the story of the martyrs that we read on Yom Kippur, one of the things that the rabbis tried to do was not only to study, but to appoint, to ordain each other. And the Romans tried to interfere with that, and they successfully interfered with it by killing the rabbis. They killed the rabbis. So that what happened in the rabbinic period, at the end of this period of time, in the second century, was that there was a severe interruption in this entire system. And the system has to reconstitute itself in some way. But what we are reading here, in a way, probably is a reflection of the system as it worked when it was working. Now, that's not to say that what we are reading now, in fact, was written by the year 132 or so, which is the year of the Hadrianic persecutions. Maybe that we're reading something that comes from a later period of time, but this is the way they read back into that system when the system was functioning. This later becomes an issue in the 16th century, when the Jewish community reconstitutes itself in Sfat in the 16th century.
Rabbi Beirav
in the 16th century, Shakoch, decides that he is going to reinstitute rabbinic ordination. Okay? He tries, and there is some rabbinic ordination at that particular point in time, and then it dies. It really didn't succeed. In our own day, there is from time to time an effort to do that, and it has not succeeded in our own time. What we consider rabbinic ordination is not the same thing, and none of us argues that it is. The Orthodox don't argue that it is, and certainly the conservative doesn't argue that it is. Our rabbinic ordination is an area of expertise and qualification in a limited area of law, that you are given sanction to make decisions in a limited area of law. In rabbinic ordination that you receive, sometimes that area is even further defined. So it is not what we're talking about here. So it's not just knowledge, it is continuity of ordination. I'll use that term ordination as it was meant in that context. Okay? Any questions here?
How does it line up with Kohanim?
Kohanim are totally separate.
But if the line is broken, can you go back to the Kohanim to gain authority, gain legitimacy through their presumably continuity and descent?
The truth is that by the rabbinic period, even in the early rabbinic period before the destruction of the temple, there was a total separation between the sage and the priest. Total separation between the sage and the priest. The priest no longer has authority, which you might read into the Torah. When the Torah refers to the priest and the judge, it's in the same verse. Okay? They could be the same person. But by the rabbinic period, in the early rabbinic period, while the temple still stood, that authority was separated. That authority had become established a separate authority. And the priest had authority in the area of the official system that functioned in the temple, and everything connected with it, including entry into the temple. And at the same time, the entire rest of the law was in the hands of the sages. Okay? So that already by this early rabbinic period, you have this, and part of the reason for that is the corruption of the priesthood. Realize that in the Hanukkah story, you are already dealing, if you read Bickerman's, if you want to give yourself some good preparation for Hanukkah, read Elias Bickerman's book, Ezra and the Last of the Maccabees. Ezra and the Last of the Maccabees. It's a fantastic book about that period. It's available in paperback. Ezra and the Last of the Maccabees. We probably have it here, but I couldn't show you where. Elias Bickerman, who was a scholar at Columbia, eventually the seminary gave him an office. He never had to teach students. It was enough for him to do his research. Bickerman wrote this book about where he emphasizes the corruption of the priesthood. And in all of the studies of the Hanukkah story, central to that is the story of the corruption of the priesthood. The people that we know as the Hasidim were the Pharisees. And those who were attached to the priesthood, that became the aristocracy. This was the aristocratic element, and they were connected with this partly because the treasury was in the temple. And the priests were the Hellenizers. Once, at the end of the reign of Alexander the Great, and the extension then of the Alexandrian Empire, which in the north was the Seleucid Empire, and in the south was the Ptolemaic Empire, namely in Egypt, the land of Israel was between the two. They were always trying to achieve dominance there. As a result of that, what happened was that internally in the land of Israel, part of the population really sought to become Hellenized, like everybody else in the neighborhood. And you can get a little piece of this at the Dura Europas. You can see the impact of Hellenism was extraordinary. It's enormous. But that led to the corruption of the priesthood. And part of the rabbinic reaction, by the time you get to the last days of the temple, was a total separation between the two. The priesthood, the rabbis really took to themselves the adjudication of the law entirely in all areas except the temple right itself. Yes.
So the time of the temple, the high priest was more powerful than the Rosh of the Sanhedrin?
Well, we don't even know, we really don't know what was happening in that period of time because we don't have enough evidence. You know, we have some biblical books that will give us a little bit of evidence about the second temple, about first temple times, and then second temple times. But we really don't know the court structure. Now, all of this material that we're reading here is really based on a reality which is even after the destruction of the second temple. Okay? It's not even contemporaneous with the time that the temple was, but it's not that far separated from it, so that we assume that at least a fair amount of what it's telling us is a pretty good reflection of what was going on. But that's as much as we know. We really can't say a lot more than that. Okay? Go a little bit further. Should see how far we got. Maika Savar. Wait a second. The Divrei Kol, all right. So what's the difference then between the limited area of admissions and loans and then all the other areas of thefts? The difference is that in the area of admissions and loans, you don't need ordained judges. You don't need that continuity of ordination. My kasava. All right. Why would it be then that the author of the Mishnah thinks that you don't need ordained judges in this particular case? Okay. Kasavar Eruv Parashiyot Katuv Kam. If he holds the view that a mixture of scriptural sections is written here, Libai Nami Mumchi, he should require ordination. V'i Kasavar Ein Eruv Parashiyot Katuv Kam. And if he holds the view that a mixture of scriptural sections is not required here, Shlosha Lamali, why do I need three? In order to discuss this, we will wait until next week. It's complicated. We'll pick this up and we'll start just at this point next week. Because that was a spoken language. That was a spoken language in the land of Israel as well as in Babylonia. But it's a slightly different Aramaic.
She's saying it was only like in the year 300.
Correct.